Welcome to episode 59 of the Hellbound podcast. Here we have Ian Rayburn back again, talking about films, movie making, horror, and we start the episode off talking about Star Trek.
I should remember the title of the episode, but I forget. We watched all of it, and Enterprise, my personal opinion, not yours, is okay. We didn't enjoy it. It wasn't great. But there's an episode, original series, we watched the Blu-rays, and it's just incredible. The transfer, Paramount did an amazing job.
Oh, wicked. Yeah,
it's where there's a traveling Shakespeare company or putting a play on different planets.
Okay.
It's so random, but Kirk and his friend, who's got this eye patch, are watching it, and it's you know the strong lighting. It's like film Vamp. It's got strong
cross
lights, and it's just glorious, right? It's glorious, and the sound,
like studio lighting. Oh yeah.
And the ambient light and all of that. Love it. They're there watching this play, and they recognize the lead actor in the play, who's like the Ian McKellen of the troupe, you know, the leader of the troupe. He's a war criminal, and they thought he was dead, and he committed war crimes. And it was all about discovering whether it is actually him or not. And the only witnesses to his crimes are Kirk, this guy with an eye patch, and a few other people. And they start to get killed it kind of parallels with this acting troupe.
Okay.
And there's nothing like kind of personal I connect with it, but it's like, I watched that. I can just watch that on repeat. I don't know why.
Oh, interesting. Who played the actor?
Oh God.
Like, is it like a big theater actor? And was he like, was there scenes of him doing just like legitimate Shakespeare?
I'm going to cut this out of this podcast, but I'm going to find it.
Okay.
Now.
Cause yeah, that I wonder
it's,
if it's like,
it's an amazing episode. Conscience of the King. It's called the episode.
Conscience of a King. Okay.
Conscience of the King. Yeah.
Of the King.
It's a much older actor. I don't recognize him from anything else, but it's just, there's something about it, like, you know, like you must have a bunch of films in your head that if you're in a certain mood or,
oh man, I hate it.
Like, I'm going to watch this for the billionth time. So this episode's like that.
Yeah. I love movies so much that episodic TV, even the most incredible, stresses me out so much because I'll watch the first, if I even get around to watching it, because I have so much anxiety about it, because if I watch the first episode and I love it, then I'm like, man, I have seven other and I can't watch them all tonight. So that, or I could not cause myself that anxiety and just rewatch a movie I've seen 10 times already.
Oh
my
God.
That I love.
It's the whole blockbuster thing, isn't it? Like
100%.
Measure Netflix. And then you spend an hour looking for something. Then you don't pick something. Then you stick on the hunt for October again.
Well, I'm sure we've talked about this. It's one of the first reasons why I loved horror movies, because when I would go to the video store with my parents, the new releases, I was so young, really didn't mean anything to me because I didn't know what that meant. And so I would just walk around looking at movies. And as a child, what's not amazing, but going into the horror section and looking at 80s and 90s VHS box art, you know, like, a lot of these movies, which are complete garbage, have great marketing in their posters or their box art. And a lot of times on the back of the box art would be like a gore scene or sometimes like a naked lady. And you're like, whoa, what is that? How do I see this? This looks insane. And then I'd go home and just think about them. And like, what was that demon? And what, you know, and then there's something so much about it. And then when Blockbuster, they did a thing where like they sold a DVD case and it was full of coupons. It was like 30 or 40 bucks or something.
Right.
And it was a gift you could give. And there was like a bunch of, it was like a little leaflet of coupons and you could rip them out. Free new release, you know, get 3 7-days for $4.99 or whatever. And so I'd always get that. And so I'd always want to use all the coupons because they expired at a time limit. And so more than half of them weren't new release coupons. They were, you know, 7-day. And so I would just rent. Then I just started renting like crazy. So I would go to Blockbuster and not even look at the new release, just go through the aisles. And you know, movies that I had read about at the library, I would get those to watch. Old movies I'd never seen, I would get those. Just weird movie. I started to learn, oh, actors were in different stuff, and I kind of liked that guy. Yeah, what else was he in? Oh, here's, you know, this movie with this guy. Okay, oh, wow, that's totally different. And then, you know, that just sort of shaped, at least opening up, you know, so much history of movies and filmmaking and stuff like that, just from watching.
Because for me, in terms of wanting to be a better cinematographer, improve it and make that part of the short film I'm currently working on, because, you know, I have a love for anamorphic, and it's not the lens flares, it's the way the focus drops off, it's the width of the image. I'm trying to learn how to frame for that. And it's a whole other ball game compared to this DCI 4K or your 16:9. So mine was The Hunt for Red October, because Jan de Bon was a genius. Yeah. And director of Die Hard, John McTiernan, is a genius filmmaker.
I know, I was going to say, Die Hard.
So when I watch Jan de Bon's work,
yeah,
especially Die Hard and being the DP of that and Hunt for Red October, I'm like, the fuck did he shoot this? Okay. Yeah. Why did he do that? Okay, that's a push in. I'm watching I love the shit out of I love the film so much.
Because I love submarine
scenes, and I love Crimson Tide because my father and I went to watch it when my mum was having breast cancer surgery. And there's a whole other thing about submarine films I love and the reasons why. But that film, for me, just teaches me every single time.
Yeah.
I go, okay, this about the way it's lit and, oh, I noticed this person's here and the blocking and all of that. And then obviously it's on a huge budget, but I'm like trying to learn all the time.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Totally. What are they actually doing? Take away all the especially though when, you know, when those movies were made, yes, there was millions and millions of dollars, but it was still all, you know, practical, even if they're in sets or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Still they had dolly tracks and they were shooting film and they had these huge canisters and these big loader, you know, these were big cameras, you know. Yeah.
And then I watched something like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which is anamorphic or CinemaScope.
Wow.
But they've got these sets as though they're shooting it you're an audience, because the camera's so physically big.
Yeah.
And but it's anamorphic. I'm like, the whole, like you were saying about your 16mm, your whole scene's being acted out in a single frame. Like,
yeah,
I can do this with anamorphic, but it, you know, there's just so much I learned from that film. And what my kind of point of talking about that was there a film that you kept watching through kind of addiction or this kind of obsession that has taught you a lot of what you like?
You know, I think, well, yes, I think I was really. I just loved movies, but I was pretty ignorant to like directors or even actors or genres. It was just like, I loved movies. And if it was R-rated or there was some violence, action, or if there was horror, of course, I'm like a guy and it was just, you know, I like G.I. Joe's chopping and wrestling. Do you say Chopping Mall?
Yeah, like you recommended that to me. I loved it.
Oh, bro, like I still to this day, and I don't think, you know, I'm like, I don't want to say I'm a nobody, but I'm not a big name or anything, but I would love to redo a serious with comedy, of course, but, you know, redo of Chopping Mall, because it's such an insane concept, but also it's like, the source material is so loose, you know, you can really but definitely I remember in 1997 seeing Boogie Nights when it came out. And I was like, oh, the porn and all drugs, you know, and then actually watching it and being like, wait, there's like six different storylines going on all at once. That camera does not stop moving. It hasn't stopped moving in every take. What is going on here? And it was one of the first time, and I had seen, you know, I've seen Hitchcock up to that point. I had seen Scorsese. I'd seen Goodfellas. But just Boogie Nights was the one that I was like, well, then I start reading up on P.T. Anderson and he's talking about his influences, Scorsese, Hitchcock. And I was like, oh, then I go and I watch Goodfellas and you're like, oh, Scorsese's doing these long oners.
Yeah.
Oh, that. And then, I went and watched Rope and I was like,
oh my God. I was just thinking, oh, yeah.
You know, okay. I can see where. So then that sort of, I remember watching Shawshank Redemption and I had seen it.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. But watching it sort of after, I was sort of in this weird new understanding or opinions I had of movies and being like, wow, this is a whole thing here.
It was like you just opened a door to a new world. Like when a friend, there's a group, that moment you had, or those moments, those kind of touchstone movies, those moments you have, we were, a friend and I, well, there's a group of us that would go to the cinema together. We'd choose a film. This was like when Michael Collins came out with Liam Neeson as the head of the IRA, the IRA.
Yep.
Alan Rickman's in it. So we would choose films to watch. And Pete Carvel, who's a writer, he lives and works in Berlin now, in Germany. We chose to watch Michael Collins, and everyone else went to watch The Island of Dr. Munro. Oh. We got the better deal.
Yeah.
So I think like a week after that, I'm sure it was a week after that, we went to Pete's house and we were all just getting drunk and it was pizza and all that, just having, just a fun time. And he'd bought a film called The Maltese Falcon. Like, what's this black and white shit?
Yeah, man.
You know what I mean, my pea brain, my dinosaur brain was thinking that.
Well, you know what? But you didn't. Yeah. You didn't.
But then when there's music cues in it, there's someone standing in the shadow watching someone from across the street going, what the fuck is this?
Did you get it immediately?
Oh, I was like,
watching it the first time, you were like,
I was like, everyone else, me and Pete were on the same wavelength. We were looking at this, but he'd already seen it. And so he said, you should definitely watch this. And I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
This is the moment where I like films, not movies.
Yeah. But you can still appreciate them. No, I get it. Because it's always entertainment for us. But then you really start to appreciate the specific style and the art, that's awesome. And you were watching that movie for the first time. So you're also like watching the movie, getting the story and being affected by all of that, which is incredible.
And we went to see Vicky's our anniversary in May when we got, so it was like I should remember the second anniversary. I'll say second. My wife will be listening and say, no, it's our first. We do a few things throughout the week. We have like a birthday week if it's our birthdays, and we do things throughout the week. And obviously cinema's a big thing.
Yeah.
But what she booked was The Big Sleep in this French restaurant. You go upstairs, and upstairs is like a cinema from in the middle of 50s France. So there's a big curtain, you go in, really nice tables. And there's a really small, the price was pretty good. They've got a huge screen and they project Blu-rays on the screen. They've got all art like La Dolce Vita posters everywhere. And
oh, wow.
And basically when they start the film or half an hour before, they close the curtain. No one else is allowed upstairs to the top restaurant. It's only the people that have booked. So it was The Big Sleep. It was a meal and two glasses of wine.
Wow.
And it was like, this is like the perfect setting. And it was kind of, it reminded me of the first time of watching The Maltese Falcon the first time.
Because
it was like such a moment. But yeah, like, Hunt for October, things like that. I'm like, it's almost like film school again.
Yep. And it really is. And you can, and if you can appreciate, it's not, at all lost on me, the internet and YouTube and, I can, as soon as we're done here, can go and either watch the full movie or just go on YouTube and watch scenes from now. I know it's not the same, but if it's like, I just need to remember what you're talking about. Oh, it's been a little while since I've seen it. Like, it's just right there. And that is so, as someone who loves movies so much, that would try any way he could to watch them, and learn.
I think it was a few weeks later when this is the fifth, I think it's the 40th release poster. I used to work as an usher, and there's a whole raft of stories and relationships and all of that from the cinemas I worked at. But this is what you call a quad poster. That's the UK size poster, 30 by 40 inches.
Okay. And, oh, wow.
There was like two people wanted this, and it was like Orson Welles on the poster. I have to have this.
Of course.
Because
yeah, of course.
When you see Orson Welles step out in The Third Man and the Harry Lime theme is playing, I was like, I don't understand what I love about this, but this is genius to me.
Yeah.
The shadows, and it was Prague. I think it's shot in Prague. No, Vienna. I think it's Vienna. And it's like, there's something about this that's like atmosphere.
Yeah.
And horror and all, not horror, but like the light and shadow. And like, I've got to get into this no matter what I'm doing in the aspect of filmmaking.
Yeah.
Got to get into this somehow, you know.
Actually, as we were talking, I just had a quick thought. I also, in and around sort of that same time, I remember seeing Requiem for a Dream was another one where I watched it and I was like, you can make movies like this?
Yeah, I remember Keith David for a really dirty line.
Well, Keith said, yeah, man, like, you know, yeah. I just, you know, I loved it. I mean, it's a weird movie to say you love, but it was like the darkness of it, what he was saying, you know, where it was shot in New York, and then, you know, the editing. And because I was making, and again, I'm a by accident editor as well, you know, it was just because I loved wrestling so much, so I would film it and then edit out the commercials, and then we would do basement wrestling and then backyard wrestling, and then, well, where's the tape, Ian? We want to watch it. And I was like, well, I don't want to just watch the garbage fast forward. So I'll just cut all these out myself, which then led to making music videos, which then led to just filming more stuff. Well, somebody needs to edit it. So then it, you know, like a lot of that just sort of happens by accident. Excuse me. Like most of what I do creatively anyways has just sort of happened by accident. Like I didn't really set out.
Do you know how we were saying earlier that I don't know if you were recording, but about the live stream of your friend, the wedding you were part of, are you the tech guy?
Yeah.
The reason I built in those contingency plans, because I do a lot of live stream stuff, is because I that cannot happen. I won't allow it to happen. So in 2001, it was my first proper edit of something, 2001. Okay. And I was at college and I learned so much on this course. Doesn't exist anymore. Lecture is not there, but I learned so much at this is before university, on this course. And it was an award show and it was interviews, you know, just off camera, eyeline and all of that. I learned just so much, even if it's just a series of sports award video, nominee videos that go up on screen. So obviously it helps with my festival stuff now. Well, that was 20 years, over 20 years ago.
Wow.
You got to get your lower thirds right, all that shit. And I learned like the hard way, and it was like Premiere 4, Premiere 6, or whatever, whatever it was.
I was Final Cut. I was Windows Movie Maker forever.
Yeah.
And then Final Cut for a bit. And then I got a PC again. And it was, I think I used ULED Video Studio Pro.
Because it was like
$40. What's that?
Do you remember SCSI drives?
I do remember. Wait a minute. What is it again? Maybe I'm thinking of something
Called SCSI here. It's like a floppy disk, but it's like high capacity, like thicker.
Oh, and like more space? Like was it like 50 megs or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
What did we call it? So I was thinking of something completely different. But yeah, that all that stuff. And that's why, just to tie it back in, when I watched Requiem for a Dream as a fan and as like a teenager, but also as someone who unintentionally would do editing, I was like, oh, you can tell story making like this, just the close-ups, the eyes, the montages, the blow being snorted and the blood. And I was like, this is like a visual artistic slideshow to prime you for the scene. What?
Yeah.
You know, and then the sound, you know, Clint Mansell soundtrack. And I was just how do I listen to this? You know, and it just scored it. And then he also, you know, doesn't shy on his graphicness. He lets it, you know, he lets it linger and he goes, you know, and I don't feel like it's unwarranted, you know, from the wrestler Black Swan. Like, I feel like a lot, it's justified. And so I love that was fountain. Another one where
I love the fountain.
Yeah. That was, yeah. And then Stalker, when I watched Stalker.
Yeah.
And I was like, they were making movies like this. I didn't know Tarkov. Like I had some ideas from education stuff, but I remember my friend Colin, you know, we watched Stalker and I hadn't seen it in forever. And I was like, okay, like,
yeah.
Wow, I'm
so just to kind of put a bow in the kind of PTSD of live streaming. When I did that edit and I put the names up, I hadn't been part of the live stream setup, so I put the nominee videos that go up on a screen. There's 400 people there, something like that, 350.
Oh my goodness!
And then a week later, I was back off a holiday. I went into class and we were filming scenes, fake scenes for a film that never got made. Okay. And I said, oh, how did it go? Because I was like, wanted to know how did my stuff sit? You know, 300 people watched it. How did they see? And everyone was quite sheepish to say anything, like, what happened? I got one of the names wrong on one of the videos.
Oh, no.
Of the winner. So basically the winner didn't have their image on, just had text and who that person was. The winner on the text was the wrong person. This person was a person in a wheelchair that did sports.
Okay.
They went up to accept the award.
Oh my God.
An award they didn't win. And they actually corrected on stage. And he fell out of his wheelchair going up the stage.
Oh my goodness.
And
I don't mean to laugh, I was
so glad I wasn't fucking there.
Can you imagine? Why didn't you go?
It was like I was going on holiday or something like that. Okay. I wanted to do it because it was like a proper mix, lights and everything.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my God. And the other person that actually won the award went up at the same time. And
was it like a shock that he fell out of the chair or like just like,
oh no, basically it was
frustration
like,
of like trying to get him.
No, he was going up on his own. There's 300 people watching
up the stairs,
up the ramp, and the wheel slid off the side of the ramp.
My goodness.
And I was like, oh my, I can't allow this to happen. So I made a pact with the devil for this never to happen again.
Yes.
So you know, I know the heartache of it not working, and I cannot allow this to happen. I have the redundancies like NASA, so.
Yeah, I had a really shitty version of ULED Video Studio. It wouldn't update, and I just kept using it. And I mean, I don't think I'd ever been more angry than when, I mean, it was like a shitty edit anyways of whatever I was working on. But if I had put in like a couple of days worth of editing and then it crashes and there's no autosave and there's no nothing, there's no project file. So I had to, I have to start again fresh. I don't think I'd ever been more angry. You know,
and it's
the worst, mind you. The handful of times that's happened, the projects always came out better, in my opinion. But there's like, thank goodness for that autosave feature.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
That's all I'll say.
I'm getting flashbacks now. I'm getting flashbacks.
Yeah.
Before I ask you about your work on Star Trek, New Worlds, is that right?
Strange New Worlds. Strange New Worlds.
Before I ask you about that. Oh God, what the hell was I going to say? I think I've completely blanked. It was a production thing. The reason, and this kind of building into contingency plans, I worked on a cinema advert for the university I do a lot of work for, and that's kind of my day-to-day thing. Okay. And we had a cinema advert, 30 seconds, and it was going across 200 cinemas in the UK. So obviously, I was so stoked. And it was on Thor, Love and Thunder, so lots of
people. Oh, wild.
So I went to see it in IMAX, and it was blown up. It was 16 by 9. It was like super incredible because my work obviously paid a lot of money for that to be aired.
Of course.
Wow. And like the stress on how that works is insane because, you know, I think I asked you ages ago, and I complimented you about your color work, and you told me ages ago you know not pro colorist and all of that, and how like these two monitors, they're balanced but they're not right, you know what I mean? They're not.
It's different, so, every single time. Like
it was £1,000 for the color. I'm not speaking out of school for this, but there's £1,000 for the colorist for a day.
Yeah.
It was $5,000 for the audio mix, even though the mix was already decent in a 9.3.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know.
Mixing lab. And it was like, you have to go through these five mixing labs, Dolby labs, yeah. Otherwise you can't have it play in a cinema. That's how it worked wild? In the UK. I was like, eh?
But what great experience for you to
Oh, I was gutted because because other people had worked, professional audio people, I wasn't invited to go to London to go and do the audio mix on my advert. So I was fucking devastated. And next year, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, well, and then that's when the industry is also a real pain. Yeah,
and that was the sound mixing room they did Gravity in.
Wild.
So I was like, oh my God. I said, you've got to take photographs. You've got to take photographs of my work on the screen.
Yeah, yeah, there. So, wow.
So yeah, it was like, there was Blackmagic footage. And it was like, shot my 6K on a gimbal. So I was like, yeah, let's see how it holds up on a IMAX screen.
And
I was
how
like,
did it?
Amazing.
Amazing, yeah.
And there's clips in that from other projects that were 720p that are blown up with Topaz's gigapixel. So I'm like, fucking awesome. Because it was a proper edit, I was super proud of it.
Yeah, wow. And
yeah, so that was like my 6K Pro on a gimbal that wasn't, it was balanced, but I was kind of stressing. And you know the whole thing with cages and you don't want to take everything off.
It's always an issue.
So yeah, it was, and then uploading it, DCM or Digital Cinema Media is the thing for uploading.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to be a TIFF image sequence. It wasn't a video file. I was like, what the hell is this?
I did it one time and I saved to my desktop by accident.
Massive.
And so then it made, you know,
you look like you had porn all over your screen.
I was like, what happened to my computer? Oh, whoops. I set it as TIFF.
Yeah.
Which is
oh my God.
People are like, what?
So yeah, it was that, I, you know, but next year, because I want to shoot anamorphic and handheld,
yeah.
I'll show you the rig before we leave. Before we finish later, I want to shoot a narrative story about a kid who loves science, and then you see him progress, and you see an older version going to college or university, mm-hmm. and that's the whole idea. He loves science; he sees all these things and
yeah.
colors, almost like an advert for a zoo.
Okay,
but that's the kind of really simple idea, and I want to shoot anamorphic because everyone's doing it now. Like there's a Cadbury's chocolate company. Everyone's shooting anamorphic.
No, you're like, it's not just commercial work anymore. Even like, excuse me, YouTubers, you know?
Yeah. But they're not doing it for the reasons.
Of course not. But it's like now it's a known thing. I mean, it always has been, but it's per choice. But now people that aren't choosing to do it are doing it because it's the trendy thing, you know, or, but that's, and I'm, totally intimidated by it. I mean, I've never shot it
myself. Oh, it's scary, yeah.
You know, I'm like, everything you post, I'm like, wow, that's incredible. I would like to work with a DP that's like, can just do that.
Yeah.
And I can just help and say what we want to do. And then,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's, because I love shooting, absolutely. But also, you know, you can't like, you know, and before we talk about Star Trek, I mean, it's not, it's like, it's not a flex or anything like that. But, you know, ideally, I don't want to make movies all by myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
it's so much more fun, isn't it, to
collaborate? Well, there's so many people. Yeah, I mean, just outside of the people. Technical stuff, filming, focus, sound, you know, it's, I am of the mindset that everyone there is a creative and can.
Yeah.
Voice their opinion at least. You know, why would nobody wants it, you know, to fail? You know, and so it's everybody has, and everything that I've worked on that had, you know, any kind of level of crew, it's always just whether it's my own or a lot of other stuff I've worked on, it's always been creatively, anyways, more rewarding because A, it's easier. And then you just have all these hopefully like minded and good creative minded people that are like, and I'm totally for it. You know, like,
yeah,
I'm, you know, I'm not Michael Bay, like where I I have it all up here, and that do what I tell you, which is all okay, fine. You know, that's the, I don't like to work like that. I like to, and like, let's be real. We're shooting digital as well. We're not shooting film. So we always have time for at least another take.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Yeah. I still say tape is cheap. Oh, I still say because of DV times, you know?
The Canon HV30. That was my first ever. HD camera.
And then when you hear that Danny Boyle shoots 28 Days Later on an XL1S or XL1, you know, with
better. It looks so sick too. Like, it.
I don't know how he got the London shots. Don't know how he fucking achieved that, because he shot down big these streets in London
early in the morning. Yeah, it's crazy. It's just, I mean, and then he's like,
no one at that point. Nobody had Shallow Grave, I think. But you know,
and then he did some music videos, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't like, what was it when they shot? Was it the Vanilla Sky remake with Tom Cruise? And then they got a little shot to him running in New York in Times Square, completely empty. It's like, you know, he didn't have that level of star power and celebrity and money. You know, I know there's stories out. I can't fully remember, but I think they did it really, really early in the morning, right? When it was.
Yeah, that's right.
And then just framing. It was like, how can we.
Yeah.
Crazy, so, though.
Speaking of large budgets and spectacle, I saw, like, Michael Chan, as you know, is the co-host, normal co-host of the Hellbound Horror Podcast. He's in Star Trek Discovery. Because you know the score, you know, because as an actor, you know the deal with NDAs. I've signed a couple for, like, wasn't Band of Brothers in 2000 when I did running work for that? It was ages ago. No one knew what it was going to be. And then, like, it was the fucking biggest thing ever. Yeah. But then when Michael, he didn't tell anyone he was in it. And, like, he's part of Live Long and Podcast. I don't know if you know, he does this teleplay thing where they all act out.
I've seen him post it. They're incredible.
He's
a big Trekkie. He loves it.
And I said to him, I understood it. That's why I wasn't annoyed.
Yeah.
But then I see another friend of mine, you, when you're in the Pope pictures you, that it's the hero shot. It's the.
Yeah, and they
reason I was so happy for you. I know it's like things are cut down.
Yeah. It's a classic entertainment industry thing, you know. I'd say about 65% was just cut out. They just cut it.
Yeah.
You know, the wedding, there were scenes in the wedding, and you know, and it was just like, and I get it too, as an editor, it's like, what's gonna go? You know, we were really there for Easter eggs.
Yeah.
Like what we were doing in the wedding. I don't know if you know about all the, like, they were recreating that wedding scene from the original 60s.
Okay.
Episode and Kirk. And so the dialogue that the bride, they kept in that saying, that's what Kirk was saying when he officiated. So, and then whoop, they get under attack and they interrupt the wedding. So they basically, in the time travel element of the season finale of that show, they just, I will ignorantly admit to learning all this after I got it. I didn't really watch a lot of the original, let alone enough to be able to pick out the, and like the makeup girl's like, you know, you're playing a guy from the 60s. We're recreating him. And I was like, really? And they had all these pictures set up when I went in for wardrobe to like do my hair. I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then, and we shot it and it was great. And of course, classic me, you know, my wife gets killed, so I have to deal with that trauma. You know, it's like, great. And the audition was great. Did it. Sure. We like him. Can you just send us a quick video of how you would react if your wife died in front of you? And I was like, what? And my agent's like, yeah, they want you to send another video. And that's the note. Just react as if you saw your wife die in front of you. And I was like, okay.
At that point, did you know what it was for?
Somebody asked me that. I didn't at that point. But if I had been a little bit more of a Trekkie and done a little bit more due diligence of looking over the breakdown, I would have saw they had Ray Bradbury's name on there in the like into the executive producer section. I just didn't look at it that close, but it was a different title. And my character was just Groom. So I was like, okay. And this was COVID. This was during COVID. So it was just a filmed audition at home. It wasn't until I got it and my agent called and they were like, it's the new Star Trek. I thought it was Discovery. And I was like, holy shit, really? And they were like, yeah, oh my God, congratulations. And I was like, what?
Wow.
I didn't even know. So then I had that excitement and terror of,
I'm gonna be on
Star Trek now. Oh shit, you know, and it was definitely, that's been one of the biggest, most recognizable things, I guess. Again, it's not a big role. I'm, you know, just like a good old Canadian day player actor. And then they cut everything, all the dialogue, all everything, but it's been really incredible.
They cut all of your dialogue?
Yeah, of course, because it's got but that's, you know, this will be the third professional project that I've been in that I was cut out completely.
Wow.
Almost. At least I'm shown. Actually, I shouldn't say that. There's been big American shows that I also got the really great privilege to be in where I was just cut completely.
Yeah. You hear stories of actors that have got named roles, dialogue, and they're in, you know, they're announced, they've turned up on the red carpet and they're cut out.
That story in Thin Red Line?
I can imagine.
They I can't remember. I don't think it was Vince Vaughn. I can't remember who it was. And they showed up to the, you know, and the movie they saw was completely different and they were not in it at all.
Yeah.
You're like,
I did love that movie. And a lot of people are kind of on the fence, but that's when I love Terrence Malick.
Well, that's the thing. People didn't understand. And for me, I very ignorantly, because I still wasn't full movies at that point, I very ignorantly was like, who cares about this long, boring war movie? I'm going to watch Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what like pulled my focus for war movies. Then it wasn't until later on I went, and I remember you could rent it and it was two VHSs and I was like, no thanks.
My Magnolia is that, you know, I had the early
Magnolia.
Two discs. Yeah.
And I watched it last night and, you know, totally worth the time. I've always loved longer form stuff. It's funny, right? Like, I'll watch a 3-hour movie, no problem, but three episodes of a show
it's the anxiety of like,
yeah,
oh shit, there's 12 seasons to go.
Well, and that's the thing too. I'm just, like, especially if it's aired and we live in now this, you know, streaming culture where it's everything's everywhere. It's like, I know this probably is amazing, but this 5, 6, 7 seasons, I'm like, stressed out of the commitment.
The commitment. It's like a relationship when you have with a show.
Yeah.
Like I watched the OA. The OA is a Netflix show about.
Absolutely.
Have you seen it?
No, but I know I don't know, but I liked the people that were involved in making
it. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And there's a cliffhanger on the end of the second season that's genius. It's absolutely genius what they do. And it's about the way you handle death and the way that's processed. And Jason Isaacs is one of the truly evil villains in this film. And he is like an Alan Rickman evil villain level.
Yeah, thing. I agree.
Love him to bits. And the cliffhanger is a work of art.
Mm-hmm.
And the head of production, she said to Netflix, this has got a 5-season arc. We've seen all the scripts. This is going to be great. Season 2 comes out. The viewing figures are what they wanted. They can it.
Yeah, they can it.
And it's devastating. It's absolutely devastating because it's a work of art. And that's the commitment phobia I have now. And then what happens a year later is there's a leaked memo from Netflix. And they say, oh, we're only really looking for shows for 2 to 3 seasons.
Wow.
Unless they're like Stranger Things.
And do you think that is because they're looking at really the bottom line of viewership?
Oh, it's casting. It's casting and production. It's all of that. Like, how much do you think Millie Bobby Brown's on now? Which, you know, all due respect, she absolutely deserves it because Tony Gandolfini, he was getting paid a lot of money for the last few seasons of Sopranos. Makes sense. But that's probably one of the reasons is that we keep the cost down. Oh, we don't need to have Henry Cavill in The Witcher anymore. Liam Hemsworth comes in.
Yeah, that's pretty wild I was, you know, and again, I don't watch The Witcher. I don't really watch episodic ignorantly, but you know, I've seen enough of it that in my opinion, it looks great. It sounds great. I think it's doing justice to the source material. And apparently he just knew so much about it. They use him as a consult as well. Cause he's like a big,
mega nerd
gamer. Yeah, he's World of Warcraft.
I love Cavill. Love Cavill.
Yeah, man. He seems so. And he was in one of the earlier straight to DVD piece of shit Hellraiser sequels.
Yes. And we'll probably save it for another episode. I think when we talk about Hellraiser, I think we'll do, if you don't mind, what we'll do is an actual episode just about the new Hellraiser.
Yeah, I would love to talk about anything Hellraiser. Hellraiser.
Well, I think what David Bruckner did, I was just stoked when I saw that trailer, the way it was shot going.
Yeah.
How the fuck did this not get a cinema release?
I mean, I would even say, how is it still not readily available in Canada and the UK?
I had to find a really dodgy way to find it. I'm going to be honest with anyone listening.
What the fuck? You know,
I watched
what are we supposed to do? Like, how are
I'm getting so annoyed with those streaming platforms. Hulu, you know, respect. It was an ownership thing, and I understand why it's not on Disney, because it's not really owned by Fox. There's a whole thing.
Yeah. So, and that's the licensing. It's always licensing.
Why are these press previews of these things like Prey? Like Dan Trachtenberg was a YouTuber, great filmmaker with his 10 Cloverfield Lane. Fantastic. Yeah, and he's nailing it. He's really nailing it. He's kind of not an understudy, but he's had a working relationship with J.J. Abrams. And I think he's going to be a genre filmmaker, but a really great one.
Mm-hmm.
Why the fuck are those previews of Prey and Hellraiser in cinemas when we can't see in a fucking cinema?
Yeah, when we can't see them. It's
but pickles my head.
You know, I really, and I mean, this is a whole thing and I won't really get into it, but I mean, as a Canadian filmmaker, you know, I love Canada, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay. We're not talking about any dumb debating that, but you know, when it comes to the business, the entertainment business, which is like what I work in, it's not just the hobby, you know, it's I also, you know, it's like I remember when I was going to America before the pandemic with some films to festivals and that, and, you know, I was always talking about just releasing and distribution and features and just trying to get as much information because I have, you know, nothing. I'm like, I want to learn anything I can.
Yeah.
And, you know, just having it illuminated to me, you know, well, when it comes to business, you know, there's 330 plus million people just in America alone, you know, Canada has 34 million. I mean, that's a massive difference in people who consume products. Now, I'm not at a point where I'm making features or any, you know, series or whatever for it, but, you know, something to think about. I can understand why, because these deals are so big for, you know, 338 million people still had the opportunity to view Hellraiser, which is a huge number. So I can understand it. It just, you know, when you're diehard horror fans like, you know, we are that happen to live in Canada and in the UK, and it's unavailable, you know, it's, as I said, if Terrifier hadn't done literally so well in America, the only place it got released at first, it wouldn't have came to Canada. It wouldn't have come to Australia. Did it go to the UK at all? Did any theaters?
I don't think so. Maybe like in London and a bunch of, you know, small.
Okay. Because I know it did Australia. I wouldn't be surprised if a couple, I mean, literally it was a handful of theaters all through Canada that you know, and I live in Toronto, which is a huge city, so of course, you know, we got one of them, thankfully. But you know, I can understand why these deals exist. It's just so frustrating in a time when everything's so accessible, things just aren't accessible.
Yeah,
you know, and the copyright.
I was like, oh yeah, I can't wait, Hellraiser Day or whatever, and then the kick in the nuts is they're all marketing it online. All the fucking people I'm following, all of that. Jamie Clayton, I love Rin Sensei.
Yeah.
Rin Sensei.
Yep.
She's in the greatest sex scene in any TV or show or movie.
Okay.
There's a sex scene with, have you seen Sense8 on Netflix?
I watched the first episode. And
you know how they
like,
all, basically they all share their own.
Yeah.
It's a sex scene with all those characters in a toilet stall. It's amazing. It's amazing. So I was just like super excited because of
she's great.
What she stands for and all of that. Sure. And that's all just extras.
And she's just like gravy, fucking awesome job too.
Yeah. And like, I'm like, and then when I see, oh, it's not on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
were you
not,
up?
It's,
did you stay up the night of?
I was like, yeah, I'll fucking all ready for it. And then
I was up. I was
in
waiting.
In the UK, there's Star. Star is part of Disney Plus, but it's, okay. I don't know if it's the same in Canada, Star.
Like Stars?
But it's that's the Fox content on Disney Plus.
Oh, okay.
So you got Walking Dead and all that other stuff. Sure. Even though it's AMC, it's you got all that stuff on there. I'm like, it's not on here. And then you try and find out. Oh, it's not being. There's still no sign about when it's going to be released in the UK.
Yeah, I think my friend said December 2nd was an iTunes release in Canada.
Yeah,
which is. Like there goes the October release, you know.
Optimal. That's the time. That's
the and the
time.
Thing is you know, I'm sure you read about it and heard about it too. It did great.
Yeah. And look at Prey. Prey was
Prey crushed.
Fantastic. And the character design,
yeah.
The non personally there's a lot we can talk about and there's some things we won't talk about, but Ripley in Alien is an amazing character, first and foremost.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what gender she is. The character in Prey is an amazing character. Doesn't matter what gender that person is.
Sure.
And this is the perfect fucking time to release this movie.
Yeah.
And you just like it's this kind of this old Warner Brothers thing. This is obviously a personal opinion of mine. Sure. I don't work in the industry, but personal opinion. When Warner Brothers tried to dump Dune onto streaming. And Godzilla onto streaming before they weren't going to go to cinema. Legendary films were getting dumped onto HBO Max. And
all
did you
of
hear
them,
about this
right.
whole thing explode?
Yeah. But Godzilla did come out in theaters, right?
Legendary budgeted both Godzilla versus Kong and Dune.
Yeah.
85% of the budget. And they were HBO were going to. Warner Brothers are going to dump it on HBO. So I'm like, and now there's this whole thing about our films do 50% better in when they go to theaters for 45 days.
Well, absolutely. And look at Godzilla vs. Kong. I mean, those movies aren't fine. But I love that it's directed by Adam Wingard, horror director.
Oh, I like him a lot. Yeah.
Great. And that movie, I remember reading, I mean, it did $1 billion at the box office. Yeah. And they were saying like, oh, you know, this is a return to force to the theater in a post-COVID world. Well, I mean, it was not a post-COVID world at all. But, you know, and to think that, you know, even like a movie like Smile was $17 million budget, was a Paramount Plus release only. Then when they saw finished versions of it, it tested so well that Parker Finn, the director, his first feature, it tested so well. They're like, all right, let's release it in theater. $210 million it made.
Was it his first feature as well?
It's his first feature. Yeah. And I had seen his in 2020, the Fantasia Film Festival was online. And so I rented a bunch of movies to watch for the online festival. And before one of the features was this short, Laura Has a Nightmare, I think it was called. Okay. And it was just a girl in a therapy session talking about this recurring nightmare she has. And it's like 15 minutes, whatever, 12 minutes. And it was just this super tight, really tense filled, beautifully shot and lit. And I was like, okay, there's a budget in this. But it was really great. And I was like, who is this? Who did it? Okay. This LA filmmaker, Parker Finn, he's got 2 credits on IMDb. Following him on Instagram. He's got like 2,000 followers, or whatever. I'm like, all right. I liked that movie a lot. It looked great. And then nothing. I forgot about it. And, you know, I'm on and off social media. And every now and then I'd pop on and post. And he started posting about Smile, my feature. And then he made it. And it was, again, just going to go to streaming. It tested well. It took human beings seeing the movie to be like, wow, that's actually really effective. Maybe we should pivot our strategy and actually release it in theaters. And then it made them, you know, $17 million budget.
So well, now someone who was head of Warner Brothers or the DC stuff, he's head of horror at Paramount now. So he shifted. Yeah, he was the one that was in the Johnny Depp trial on video camera talking about Aquaman. Okay. And he produced that. Now he's head of horror for Paramount. Like,
interesting.
And now you hear Jason Blum is joining forces with James Wan.
Yeah, man. I mean, there's never... I was listening to Quentin Tarantino talk recently, and you know, he was asked about current media, and he didn't really want to comment on current media. And he's talking a lot about the pendulum of eras of film, you know, going back and forth. And I mean, I love old movies of every era, you know, including like 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago, you know. But for a horror fan and as a horror creator, you know, I get so much inspiration. Like, I don't even care really what people think about Terrifier 2, and it has very polarizing thoughts. I'm just so inspired that this movie with no real budget, with no studio, basically made by like a 9-people crew with the writer director doing all of the practical effects himself and everything, you know, it just, and then made, you know, a lot of money, $10 million. To me, it's like there's no better time. And then Barbarian and Smile and Halloween. And, you know, this is a really, it's like horror is still alive as a feasible financial option. You know, I mean, if we're talking just straight business and numbers, you know, it's still a very marketable. I mean, I saw Nope in theaters in IMAX with a full crowd, and I had forgotten what seeing like a scary movie in a crowd was like.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, and regardless of what I thought about Nope, and I liked it, I loved the sensorial experiences of everybody jumping. There was a couple on a date beside me, and she was really scared, but not annoying, you know? And it was just like the perfect, I was like, found myself like trying to not be creep, but like watch that. It was,
yeah.
You know, oh my God, don't go there. No, you know, and it was like, this is exactly what
I used to do that quite a lot. And
of course.
Join myself and Ian Rayburn next week as we continue to talk about filmmaking and all things horror. All right, bye-bye.